This is AVXL episode 21, recorded July 28th, 2016.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. All right, I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater gear and content. No matter what your budget is, good stuff coming up, people. Vizio P-Series finally gets the HDR10 update. Vizio gets sold. We got some color gamut updates, some Atmos help, more 4K Summer Olympics providers, and yes, people, viewer questions from you. Ask at AVXL.com is the place to send them, or at AVXL, at Patrick Norton, or at Robert Heron. Speaking of which, I am still at Patrick Norton, and joining me, as always, is at Robert Heron.
Yay! At.
Sorry.
Robert is at.
Oh, no. My goodness. I'm still stuck back on, it was a rough week for Twitter, you know. Well, basically, Facebook's like, we have 1.7 billion users and 1.2 billion users on mobile, like, every day.
We just had our stock reevaluated to $165 a share.
I love Twitter, but, you know, Twitter's having a rough week. So some love for Twitter.
I simply want them to have some consistency across their apps on different platforms.
Like, good luck with that.
The Android mobile app is pretty awesome. You can switch between accounts just with a touch of a button. I can't seem to find that similar experience on my Windows notebook.
You know, I'm about to start singing Aerosmith's Dream On, but I'm going to try to spare us both and everyone listening right now from that terrible, terrible experience. I'll apologize in advance for something I haven't done yet. Oh, my goodness. While I'm in full advertising mode, if you enjoy AVXL, please contribute to the show at patreon.com/AVXL, because the people who donate there make the show possible, and we thank each and every one of you.
And please slide over to the website at avxl.com, and you can find links to everything, including our support page, all of our recorded episodes, show notes, those sweet show notes.
Sweet show notes.
Those show up in our RSS feed, too. That's what I really like. So when I pull it up in my podcatcher, I've got the show notes right there, and I don't have to go surfing around.
A giant pile of excellence with feet. Oh, my goodness.
It's the bridge over the River Kwai in 4K.
I'm going to just not look at that, because William Holden is mesmerizing in any film.
I didn't realize what an aspect ratio this particular film has.
It's
way wide.
This was when they were shooting everything way wide. But let us not get me talking about classic cinema and Panavision and such.
There's a little film grain there.
Well, anyway. It was shot on film, Robert, back in the day. We're just kind of, you know, big news that came out this week. Shocking, delightful news. I guess for the owners, the company that made HDTV affordable, faster for everyone, or if you're Samsung or LG or any of a long list of companies that have been battered by their HD manufacturing wings, the company that made it harder to make money faster, Vizio, was sold to Chinese corporation Le Echo, which I'm going to say is, if I can speak French without making French and Quebecois people just horrified, $2 billion. It's going to be operated as a wholly owned subsidiary. The Inscape data business, i.e. Vizio's tracking of what you do with your television, has been spun off into a privately owned company held by Vizio CEO William Wang. Deal is expected to wrap up later this year. And quite frankly, we don't know how this is going to impact Vizio televisions, but I'm going to brazenly assume that Le Echo bought them because they were doing a lot of things right.
Exactly. Everything I've seen so far, it seems to indicate nothing's really going to change. Vizio's still going to be Vizio. I'm curious to see if other aspects of Vizio's production beyond TVs is really something that Le Echo is interested in as well, maybe for mobile products or other things like that. It's an interesting buy. Honestly, $2 billion for Vizio? I don't know why, but that seems kind of cheap. But,
well,
it seems like such a dominant brand name here in North America, at least, and I'm sure slowly around the world. But
a lot of
two aren't.
It's hard to make money. Remember, Vizio went into trying to make laptops and desktops because they thought the margins were higher there, which made some acquaintances of mine, some friends of mine at major PC manufacturers go, "Oh my goodness, our margins suck. How horrible are the margins on HDTVs?" You know, congratulations to William Wang and the rest of the crew, and we wish them well, and we hope they keep making awesome televisions. Affordable televisions.
My dealings personally with that company, too, have been pretty positive. They're technologists within the company. generally speaking, they're very focused on what the cost is and what the end result will be. And they are as video centric about producing good imagery as anybody I deal with. Yet at the same time, it's the features, the selection of features that go into TVs and how to keep that cost is, you know, what features don't you need? That's why they were one of the first to abandon 3D, got out of the plasma business. They were basically looking to go into the future for the most energy efficient stuff possible and to produce good picture quality, good prices. And I think they pulled it off pretty well.
Yeah.
I have no complaints. They've gotten better just about every year I've looked at them.
A couple of our friends are convinced that that Vizio is the Dodge of television production in the sense that it's great for the first 3 years, then the wheels fall off. As a owner of a Dodge truck, I will not comment, but I do love the Cummins engine in my Dodge truck. But I, you know, Vizio's done some amazing things for getting good picture quality into the hands of people in a way that they can afford.
I respected them for going credit card full array local dimming on value price TVs.
That was shocking and delightful.
And now going HDR on now, value dime.
A number of you are now pitching your headsets, hopefully before you've pitched your headsets into the lake or out the window of your subway train. We want to tell you that if you bought a Vizio P-Series television and were irked at the lack of HDR10 support, which was we were told was coming later, at FM Holti tweeted us that he saw Matt McRae, and props at FM Holti for all the good tweets. He saw Matt McRae post in the AVS forums that the HDR10 update for P and M-Series Vizio TVs should be dropping this week.
Yeah, so, and earlier this morning, in confirmation, Mr. McRae, the CTO at, or this is he CEO or CTO? I think he's CEO.
We can look
at he's CTO. CEO is William Wang. He announced that, hey, it's already rolling out. And I have had a couple of users actually mention that they are receiving it. And if you're curious as to what the actual number is for the update coming up, if you want to just check your TV real quick and compare... Let's see if I can find that info in 5 seconds here.
Mr. McRae is the CTO and head of marketing at Vizio.
Thank you. One of the nicest, smartest people I've dealt with in the whole industry as far as that goes. And
we're just full of love today.
I'm telling you, it's just he is excited about display systems. So, and he works for a company that makes affordable systems that everyone can, you know, it isn't out of reach for most people. And
we've been looking at a lot of expensive stuff in the past few weeks, so it's nice to talk about stuff that everybody can afford.
You pay good money for anything. It's probably going to be glorious, and you expect it to be, but it's nice when you get those great deals. Oh, okay, here it is. Firmware version 20.0.13.13 is one that one of the users has received that has the new firmware. So if you take a look in your service menu on your Vizio P or M series, if it's going above version 20, you're probably in the ballpark.
Woot.
Yeah. It's good. Good to see that roll out. I can't wait to actually see some test results based on Ultra HD, Ultra Blu-ray playback, basically.
You can expect Robert with his grubby little paws and his grubby little light colorimeter going nuts on that in the near future.
I know a handful of people who own those new Vizio TVs with Samsung's player and have yet to experience that. So they're going to be enjoying that.
I should also point out that Robert's colorimeter is not grubby. His hands, however, can be grubby at times.
Without a doubt. I was gardening yesterday. I apologize.
Color gamut updates. CIE 1976 versus 1931.
Yeah, here's some nerdy crap. there's somebody I follow in the industry.
It's hot in the warehouse. So when we're not full of love today, we're probably a little cranky. So it's like 100 degrees outside, and we've been watching the mirage form on the underside of the ceiling here.
If you guys want to know one person I follow to learn from, it's a gentleman by the name of Dr. Raymond M. Sinera, and he is the president of DisplayMate Technologies Corp. This company's been around for a long time. They've made test packages that we used to use back in the day at PC Magazine and stuff for testing computer displays and things like that. Test patterns, animated screens, things like that. He recently did an article, though, related to color quality and what these new displays are capable of compared to what they used to do. And he goes over the reporting of color information, shows you relative scaled examples of the different color spaces when we talk about old standard definition TV and HD TV and now the ultra high definition. They all use slightly different color spaces, sizes of color palettes. And he does a really good job of presenting not only that information, what those gamuts, how they compare in terms of size. He actually has a really nice chart with scaled information. But he also gets into a particular aspect of when people report color information, they use a certain kind of chart, and it's called the CIE diagram. And there are two main versions of it. One is called the 1931 diagram, and one's called the 1976 diagram. What his article, and I'll link to this, of course, in our show notes, what he's trying to say here is that if you're ever going to look at this color information or report it, don't look at the older 1931 charts. The uniformity of how the color is spread out on that chart is not uniform. It has significant errors. So moving a set number of units on that chart isn't the same everywhere on that chart. And it makes it very difficult then to evaluate or compare color errors across the available color space. So what this 1976 chart does, and I'll stop right here, but it effectively eliminates that non-uniformity. It makes it a uniform color space. And visually, there are some distinct differences that are worth noting. In particular, how green is represented on the old chart and the new chart, and the other colors too, but green is the one you'll really notice. In particular, the old system really exaggerated green's dominance mm-hmm. compared to the newer chart and in how we see. If you're dealing with any of this or you're reading articles and you happen to notice one of those cool color triangle charts that show you a plotted series of points, take a look for what type of chart it is. It'll either have that number 1976 or 1931. If you see anyone still using the 1931 charts, encourage them to step up and toggle the switch to the 1976 charts for something that gives you better information, easier to just glance at and see, oh. And if you do see that 1931 chart, realize that the plotted point and its error is not uniform. So mm-hmm. it could be more of an oval shape or a circular shape in terms of the acceptable area of where that point should land. And
interesting.
It's super nerdy, but man, if you really are interested in the core of what makes a display good versus one that isn't, Dr. Raymond's Sinera's webpage over at displaymate.com is awesome.
Yeah. If you've never been to displaymate.com, just go there. Stuff. It's a fascinating. There is more information than you can possibly absorb in many visits. And they talk about everything from smartphone and tablet displays.
He works with every manufacturer, and he does some of the most detailed analysis. Yeah. And his display comparisons, like he's a big fan of Apple because they do really good work of late. Mm-hmm. Covering HD color and now moving into the expanded color palettes on tablet devices. They're some of the best display systems out there right now. And
Display made some pretty cool software too.
If one thing I could say in props to Dr. Sinera is that his work has really, it seems, has gotten a lot of these companies focused on at least providing a mode within the device to provide accurate color. Whether or not it ships in that mode being enabled or not is a whole other story, but at least somewhere within that device, it can be capable of producing, you know, accurate reproduction.
Accurate reproduction.
That's the goal.
It is.
Last time
and
I looked. And no, I can't believe I probably just talked for 5 minutes about the CIE diagrams.
It's cool stuff. It really is.
And if you would like a visual look at a CIE diagram, I think I have a quick hit coming up on Tech Thing.
Yes.
Discussing all things calibration.
Oh my goodness. We should we're gonna shift gears here a little bit just for the sheer unbridled joy of it. I'm still, you know, I'm going to bring us right back to color gamuts. I was still kind of blown away by, you know, our discussion last week about the Sony TV, the H40,
their new 940D.
The
75 inch beauty,
where there are essentially, limited or no, color controls in the television that are accessible. Even if you have the magic, you know, access codes
may be stuff in there, but nobody's nowadays found tells them. You to go there. No, I can get them, but okay. It's like there's even pro calibrators that usually don't step foot in there anymore.
But essentially though, by shifting the white balance using the tools inside the television that are accessible to end users, you can fix color issues. So that's
I dig that. And yeah. I kind of referenced this on the last episode too, but I talked about that Samsung DLP TVs back in the day mm-hmm. and how you would take that white measurement value. It's like the TV would shine a white square and then it's like you put up a white pattern, measure it. And then the TV would say, okay, what did you just measure? What was the color point on that? And it's like, okay, if that's what you just measured, then we'll calculate out the rest because the imaging system is such. Granted, this was projection with a pretty consistent light output and way to adjust. It's basically a flipping DLP chip. So it's not pushing through plastics and things like that. It was just, you know, on and off. and that makes it really easy to control light output and things like that. So its grayscale setup generally, once you did it through that method, was flat, beautiful, and right on target. And that would be, I'm just kind of curious to see if something similar, if a similar system is what Sony's using on that 940D, in right. a sense, where they base everything off of the color of white. And as long as you've got that on target, it can then calculate out and do everything else properly. Now, granted, I've also said time and again that the more premium TVs are going to be better calibrated at the factory before they even leave. So, and considering the 940 is just one step down from that new super premium set that Sony introduced earlier this month, that should be a good TV right out of the box. However, after I set the white point, we went and looked at some HDR content on the 940D, and mm-hmm. it looked better. It looked even more saturated afterwards, or accurately so. So not only did fixing that white point or properly adjusting the white point set the TV up for just superb HD playback for your regular content, but when we fired up the ultra high def Blu-ray player, man, that just, it looked dynamite too. And then, of course, we discovered the brand new AVR, the 4K AVR we were dealing with, wasn't compatible with the Blu-ray players. So I'm telling you, oh, folks, pro tip. If you're thinking about buying one of these new nice AVRs that supports 4K and HDR and everything, go take a look on the AVS forum or some popular forum where people own it and are actually connecting these devices and see what kind of issues are currently afoot. I am running into little quirks left and right related to specific product support, mm-hmm. Signal pass-through, things like that. You are on the cutting edge. Tread carefully.
Tread carefully. You will probably go insane even if you do. For now.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness. Got a viewer question from Brian, who is trying to figure out how to deal with the glory of Atmos. Now, Brian has a very unusual situation. In terms of how his speakers are configured, but a lot of the stuff we're going to talk about for him applies to anybody else. Brian's a patron. Thank you, Brian. He says, I love the show. Thank you again, Brian.
Sweet.
I've got a home theater that I had a professional install 7.1 surround sound speakers in wall a few years ago, and all the speakers were installed above head height. The fronts and rears are in the wall where it meets the ceiling, and the center and sides are in the ceiling. Now that Atmos is a thing, I was thinking I could easily add a few floor-standing speakers in front and some bookshelf speakers in back at sitting height and upgrade to Atmos with not much cost. Until I looked at the cost of a receiver that supports 7.1.4 audio with a built-in amplifier. We're talking $2,200 plus. Is it worth spending that kind of dough? I know at some point in the next few years I will be upgrading my projector. Patrick's beloved Optoma HD20 purchased from Woot, same as him, best $675 I've ever spent, to 4K once the price comes down. But will having those extra few channels really make sense in an 11 by 14 spare bedroom I converted to a theater? I can say that I've already soundproofed the room as best as I can with 3/8-inch foam matting on the floor for Kinect gaming foot comfort, as well as hanging lots of man cavey stuff on the walls. Any advice would be appreciated. Brian in Westfield, New Jersey. So part of what's interesting is a lot of what will keep sound inside of a room kind of working backwards is by sealing the room, having no, basically having no holes, that are open at the base of your door, for example, or having a good seal on the door. You can get pretty unhinged really quickly.
Oh, if there is a physical opening, sound will flow right through that and effectively act as if there is no wall there at all.
Yeah.
And depending on the size of the gap and other things too.
It doesn't take a very big gap to let a tremendous amount of audio out. If you are thinking about getting crazy with soundproofing a room, number one is that if the room's not sealed, audio is going to get out. If you want to get kind of crazy about it, using green glue and sound absorbents, sheetrock can do some tremendous things.
There's some options if you need to create a more soundproofed environment for not a lot of money.
Quiet Rock is one of them. There's several brands out there. It's basically a modified sheetrock formula. And then if you what a lot of people do is they actually use green glue to glue the, either if they rip the old sheetrock out, the green glue is essentially an elastomer that isolates motion
from the sheetrock to the studs in the wall, right? Because there's this stuff that's carried through the air.
Or even between
stuff that's
dual
vibrated.
Layers of sheetrock.
That was the next thing I was going over. They just put a second layer of sheetrock over it with the green glue, isolating it from the
isolated
the
walls.
Sheetrock. Yeah. And isolated walls are about the only way you're going to really contain
and,
the sound.
You know, you can
room.
Do floor treatments too, and that's great if you're dealing with an upstairs environment and the folks below you need to have some privacy. I was in a home the other day that was set up like that. Also, maybe you have a noisy neighbor or something that you just want some privacy. And that's another reason to have that quiet room. But in his case, he's got this speaker set up. And the question then becomes...
It's in the wall. But I was going to say, the problem Brian's going to have with isolating sound in there is that the speakers are in the walls and in the ceiling. So the audio, a significant amount of the audio comes out of the back of the speaker and is going to basically isolate or do an end run around any of the room treatments.
So
there.
Depending if there's something above that room, that might... not contain the sound. But in terms of driving all the speakers, that's the differentiation I see between the two-speaker Atmos systems and the four-speaker systems. It's where you're going from that 9 to 11 speaker amplification.
There
that's
are
where
no
the price
cheap...
just jumps.
Yeah, you can find, and it's you know, I had a chance to do, I was doing an article on Atmos for Tested, and I had a chance to go to Dolby Labs, which are in San Francisco on the other side of the bay. And, you know, one of those tremendous Dolby experiences were first, like, I love you, Dolby, but turn the volume down. You know, because they run everything at like 105 decibels. The sound is perfect, but it will blow your eardrums into the center of your skull. So once they turned it down, the Atmos demonstrations are pretty impressive. This was with a full set of focal speakers, literally probably like an 11.2 or 11.4.4 setup.
A couple hundred thousand dollars worth of speakers.
Certainly $50,000 worth of speakers. But, you know, this is one of Dolby's super special rooms.
So this is like the best, and it was to you impressive. Was it demonstration content, or was it happen to be a movie title?
It was demonstration content, and the one that, the movie that really was incredible.
Because on the back end for Atmos, I like the concept of virtualized points of audio sources that the artist can lay out, and then that can then be translated to any kind of speaker system, depending on the number of channels and things like that.
Well, they've got a pretty good... So the idea of, you know, so you're sitting in a surround sound room, right? You have a speaker at the television, point source of audio. It's monophonic. It's pretty miserable. Stereo speakers on the television are a step up. Going to, you know, any kind of stereo speakers outside of the speakers should be a step up from that. When you start getting really serious is when you turn on the Dolby or the DTX with a surround sound amplifier, and you have three discrete channels in the front, left, center, and right, because they do the stuff in the center of the screen, comes from the center speaker. That's, especially helpful. With when people are talking and such, right? Then you get the rear surrounds. Then you get the secondary rear surrounds for 7.1. And oh, by the way, that .1 is important because so much of cinematic impact, especially if you like things that blow up, is all of the stuff that shows up on a subwoofer that is way out of the range of normal musical range. Like the vast majority of music is pretty much done between like 100 hertz. 41 hertz and 700 hertz.
So for that setup you were listening to, you had the four channels above you?
Four channels above, full array of speakers.
And then, so do you think having just two would be significantly degrading to that experience? Should you just skip this altogether if you're worried about the cost and just stick to the five one you have and optimize that?
Talking to people who are smarter and wiser and can do math, I think the majority, because what Atmos does is instead of surrounding you with sound, right? And to a certain degree, I would be really interesting to experience Brian's theater because all of the speakers are up by the ceiling. Most of my speaker layouts, because I have a relatively manageable spousal acceptance factor, thank you, beloved spouse creature. She's been really good about, I've got some wonderful KEF T301s all around the room, which are big, you know, they're skinny. They lay flat against the wall, but it's essentially it looks like a big black stripe of duct tape. So we hid those by, like, they're surrounded by art and pictures and stuff.
Brian's set up similar to what I have in the living room of the house I'm in right now, and with a center channel right in the wall, right below the TV, that's mounted on the wall, and then the other four channels up in the ceiling,
right.
And then the sub off in the corner.
Yeah.
And it works pretty well. It's not. Yeah. I don't think it's ideal.
Well, it's funny because when you get
but with proper setup, it sounds pretty good.
The left and right, when you get to a surround sound, are basically to your left and to your right. Then you go to 7.1, and they're basically behind you on the left and on the right.
This was more like the speakers are going here. You deal with it.
Yeah, and that's
that was the scenario I walked into. So
that's a lower spousal acceptance factor. But what's interesting, right? So that wraps you in sort of 360 degrees of sound. What Atmos does is it fills in the sound kind of from your ear level up to the ceiling. So in terms of the demonstrated sound, enveloping you, coming down from
not
above,
only just around you but also above you.
Yeah, and that gets really amazing. Like, you know, the canned demos they do is like a thunderstorm, or you're in a jungle and the rain starts, and it's pretty impressive because there's just a whole lot of audio, you know, in places where you're not used to hearing it. In terms of a practical demonstration, what was absolutely mind-blowing is the opening scene of Gravity.
Oh,
what
cool.
I think is the opening scene of Gravity. We're all hell broke. So basically, like, you know.
On my short list of things to watch.
If you haven't seen Gravity, it's pretty exciting. But George Clooney and Sandra Bullock are, you know, maneuvering in space. I think they're fixing a satellite or whatever it is. I can't remember at this point.
No spoilers.
And the meteors come through.
Oh, thanks.
Oh, man. Great. I've just ruined it for you. Sorry. And for everybody listening, maybe you should bleep that part out.
You're stuff happens.
Usually I'm so good about not doing spoilers. Well, that's in the first like 3 minutes of the movie.
Let me pour some salt in that wound.
In any case, you know, the meteor strike was...
Oh, it's too late. I already know.
Goodness.
I understand. Okay, I'll show
But you. But the meteor strike in this particular case was much more impressive with Atmos, right? So
cool.
Long, drawn-out introduction there. A lot of speaker companies are basically providing either speakers with a pair of with an Atmos driver in the top of the speaker, or discrete speakers that basically sit on top of your existing speakers as an upgrade. And those actually bounce the audio off the ceiling. Is it more precise to have it in the ceiling? Probably. Is it very, very good coming off the top of the speakers? Absolutely. This is all a long setup to say, I would say, especially in a room that small, I would probably go with, you know, a two-channel setup. Is it perfect? No, but it's not like you have, you know, five rows of five people in a 40 by 40 foot room.
But he does have 7.1 there.
Yes.
And man.
But you can get for $400-$600 a very nice AVR that's going to support Dolby Atmos.
Totally.
You know, and it's not going to cost you $2,000. You know, and I would say above all that, above and beyond all that, you know, Atmos is pretty early. I expect it to be fairly well adopted, but there's not a tremendous amount of Atmos content, although the Olympics are promising to be in Atmos, which is just an absolutely mind... Like, I would really be fascinated to hear Atmos effects, you know, when the crowd goes nuts.
Okay, I think that's the good takeaway then. It's like, I'm not spending $2,200 on something that might only be... that I might only really appreciate with a handful of titles, and
right.
That's it. Forget that. You know, wait and see, or at least go do some sampling of this content first to see what's available.
If your AVR is a little dated and you wanted to get ready for 4K, or maybe you want to see what a... Because I would
much rather tell this person, tell Brian to say, hey, go get that 4K AVR and make sure it does your full 7.1 support and enjoy the hell out of it and continue. But maybe skip the Atmos thing. Specifically because the four channels in the ceiling, the difference between a 2 and a 4 channel support for Atmos in the AVRs I'm seeing at least, that most of them are 9 channels of amplification to do Atmos 2 channel. And then there are 11 channel amplifiers to then do that extra 2 channels to get the 4 up in the ceiling. And when you make that jump from 9.1 or 9.2 to 11.2, that's when you're getting into the super premium amps that... Great, they do it all. They're beautiful, but yeah, look at Brian found one for $2,200.
Yeah,
it's like,
and a lot of them that are for sale for around $1,000 support like 7.4, but require you to add an additional stereo amplifier for those last 2 channels.
I would also encourage him too, if he hasn't already, at least experiment with the system with an AVR that's capable of just simply doing Dolby True HD or DTS HD Master Audio. That's a lossless format, and we'll have that experiment first with a very affordable, with a good, solid, affordable AVR where you're switching back and forth between just simply Dolby Digital and Dolby True HD or the DTS versions.
DTSX.
And really appreciate that. Because there are multiple standards out there. You have DTSX Aura 3D, Dolby's surround system, and you know how much content is there for the money you're looking to spend, but you already have the speakers. I would roll with it.
Yeah, I would almost say, you know,
it's hard for me to tell this person to upgrade unless they really just want to be on the cutting edge, and it doesn't sound like it. Maybe that room is a little small to be putting all the speakers in the world in, but you want good audio quality. I'd be more focused on just optimizing what he has.
I mean, because the stuff that Atmos does, right, it's very head transfer related functions, point source audio. You know, you can pick up for, you know, when they get back in stock, ELAC makes a couple of Dolby Atmos speakers that Andrew Jones designed. You know, it's $230 for the pair. You know, you could experiment with those. Pioneers.
He said the center insides are on his ceiling.
Yeah.
Oh, that's even odder.
Yeah. Well, you know, I would probably say like, you know, you can pick up Pioneers. Pioneers sold their home audio division, but they're still doing the SPT22A add-on speakers, which are, again, an Andrew Jones design to do Dolby Atmos. Those are $160 for the pair. You know, the ELAC A4s are another option.
But it comes back to needing an AVR to drive it all.
Yeah. But, you know, $200 for a couple speakers to put up in the front of the room and bounce off the ceiling.
True. To do an AVR setup.
Yeah. That's
in the realm of if you want to do it and you want to keep it reasonable and affordable, forget the 4-channel for now. Even though you've got them up there, maybe when those amps become a little more affordable in a couple of years, you upgrade then. And you got the speakers in the ceiling ready to go. Add a couple of towers or whatever.
You know, it's something to consider. I mean, you can pick up, you know, for less than, like, you know, $379 refurbished, $479 new, a Denon AVR S710 or S720. Those are doing 4K, Ultra HD. They support, you know, 2-channel Atmos. You know, at that point, it's you're not looking at it and thinking, like, I have a $2,200 boat anchor. You know, or you can, you know, try it, and if it doesn't work, return for you. I mean, it's also, you know, the reason I want to, you know, update, you know, my umpteen-year-old, probably 5-year-old AVR at this point, my Dolby, is not anything with the audio quality. It's not with anything it's doing with HDMI, although its HDMI switching is taking a little bit longer than I'd like at this point on some of the Blu-rays. But the fact that the menuing systems and I think the switching and the setup is so much better on contemporary AVRs to compared to where they were.
Yeah, something that's not too old. I have a mid-range Yamaha from a couple years ago, and I it just works, so I have no problem with it. It's a 7.1 receiver, and I use it currently in a 5.1 setup, and I'm super happy. It does the decoding I need. Mm-hmm. It's not going to support the latest and greatest formats, nor will it ever probably be upgraded again, but does my HDMI switching, supports 1080p 60, and it takes care of decoding of my favorite lossless audio formats, in addition to cool sound modes like 7-channel stereo or whatever, just for audio, just general audio listening for like where you're not doing critical listening.
Yeah.
I like it for radio stations and things like that.
Not a huge list of Atmos titles at this point. You know, Dolby.com has a list of Atmos theater releases and Atmos Blu-ray releases. In fact, the movie releases go out through, you know, Spider-Man Homecoming, Wonder Woman, Baby Driver, Lego Batman, and Monster Trucks, which I haven't even heard of yet. Those are 2017 Dolby Atmos movie releases, theater releases. And that might be something to do, Brian, is to go to an Atmos-equipped theater and see if you kind of like it. You know, there's not a huge list of Atmos titles at this point. I'm looking at the Blu-ray list, Blu-ray and streaming. You know, 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi, Age of Adeline, American Sniper, on Blu-ray, American Sniper, as a separate title, listed as streaming on Vudu, Bram Stoker's Dracula, Capture the Flag, Chappie, Concussion, Doctor Who, Dark Water, Death in Heaven, Edge of Tomorrow, streaming on Vudu, Enchanted Kingdom, Ender's Game, Entourage, streaming on Vudu, Everest, Blu-ray, Game of Thrones, Season 1, 2, 3, 4,
all right.
5, all on Blu-ray, Goosebumps, Gravity, Hancock, In the Heart of the Sea, both on Blu-ray and streaming on Vudu. You know, there's not a huge list. I'd say there's probably less than 100 titles on this. So it is, again, for the fourth time, we'll come back to this. It is in the early days of Atmos. You know, there's a lot of people out there with like 9.1 systems that are kind of kicking rocks every time they think about the extra speakers and the amplifier they bought, because fundamentally, there's just not a lot past 7.1.
No. And the thing, too, I mean, you can always use those extra channels for other zones of audio within the home that are independent and controllable, that's which true. Is always kind of cool. However, yeah, I would just be – one thing he didn't get into in this email is how does it currently sound with this current hardware? Is it giving him good results currently? Is there anything he could do, you know, to improve? Like, are the speakers adequate for right. what he's doing? Is he able to get decent sound with his current gear? Or has he ever ran, like, a room calibration setup on it or something like that? Mm-hmm. Just to, you know, check everything.
I love the automated calibration on AVRs. Even on my aging one, it's still – the Odyssey is still pretty fantastic.
You got to be careful doing them, but – use a tripod, mm-hmm. put it right where your head would be, and point it straight up at the ceiling, and don't get it too close to anything too soft and cushy where it soaks up too much of the sound and messes it up. If it sounds odd after you run the auto calibration, move that Michael around a little bit.
Yeah.
You probably had it in an odd spot.
We talked in an earlier episode about the different sort of flavors of like Odyssey calibration and other calibrations, and off on, with the more expensive AVRs, you get a more sophisticated calibration that modifies the audio signal to deal with, you know, like 32 locations around the room, which is a little extreme if you're.
That takes a long time to run through that.
Oh, my goodness.
One nice thing, though, about Odyssey's setup for their speaker calibration on all the AVRs I've used it on is it includes a specific subwoofer level setup where it listens to the sub running a tone through it, and it gets your volume on that right away. Because one thing I find on my older Yamaha, it's not that old, but once I do the speaker setup, if it's automated, I'll take a look at the resulting values, and if anything got... like if the sub had to be turned down negative 10, mm-hmm. its max value in order to compensate it, then I probably have the sub turned up a little too high, and I'll go ahead and knock that back down and rerun it. And so the system isn't having to twist all of its internal knobs as hard as possible to make everything work. Try to get it all in the ballpark before you even start. So
there you have it. Oh my goodness.
So sweet.
Man, we got a question from Aiden DeJong, tweets at Robert Heron. I'm looking for an AV receiver to power my 2 4-ohm loudspeakers.
That's loud.
I plan to expand to surround sound eventually. Suggestions?
What's the point of dropping from, say, like the standard 8-ohm? I see 6-ohm speakers too, but those are usually like oddities.
We could get...
What happens?
Really nerdy.
Is it louder? Is it more powerful?
So ohms are a measure of resistance.
Oh, okay.
And the lower the resistance of the speaker, the more power your amplifier or the amplifier inside of your receiver can pump into it if the amplifier is rated for that kind of speaker or for that ohm rating on a speaker. And this is an area we can get profoundly nerdly on.
Generally, are like the loud systems you go to concerts and stuff running at lower than low ohm systems?
Well, what I know about concert systems, I can write on the inside of a matchbook, right? Okay. But you occasionally run into audiophile speakers that are 4-ohm. The vast majority of speakers these days are 8-ohm.
True.
Right?
But I do run into like Martin Logan's and some other, no, those are electrostatic. I forget what they ran at.
Probably six ohms.
Yeah, I've ran
maybe
into.
Maybe 4 ohms. But so, you know, the lower the ohm rating, kind of the less resistance it offers. With 2-ohm speakers, it's usually like, you know, car subwoofers. Right, you don't run into that kind of load a lot. You know, there's Audioholics, which is a wonderful site.
Oh, the best.
They are amazing. Someday I want to buy them, you know, beers and whiskey and thank them.
I like watching
for
their videos,
they
too.
They're good stuff. They've got a great article that talks about, like, connecting 4-ohm speakers to an 8-ohm receiver.
Oh, cool.
You know, including a discussion where they found out where, like, the 8-ohm, 4-ohm switch on the back of most receivers is just reducing the rail voltage.
Oh.
So they're basically like, don't, you know, leave it set to 8-ohm. You know, I was shocked to find out a lot. It's interesting, as you start digging into the specs, you'll find out a lot of AVR receivers are rated for 6 ohms, and I probably wouldn't connect a 4-ohm speaker to an 8-ohm or a 4-ohm speaker to a 6-ohm receiver. That said, I was shocked to find out. I want to say those like Denon AVR 720Ws, I believe, are actually rated, as I click on the specifications sheet for the fourth time in a row. Because apparently, there it goes. Sorry. Like, apparently, it only takes me 4 times to click on this to get it to download. But, you know, that wire cutter favored. AVR is actually related for a 4-ohm load. 165 watts per channel is maximum output channel. That's going to be noisy. 75 watts per channel at 8-ohm, 110 watts per channel at 6-ohm. And, of course, now I can't find the 4-ohm reference.
But I found several AVRs that were rated, you know, under $1,000 that were rated for 4-ohm loads.
Well, this is something else, too, that, and the last time I dealt with this scenario in particular, somebody was using the pre-outs on an AV receiver into a dedicated amplifier. And I think they were using single amps for every two speakers. And, or were they monoblocks? I forget off the top of my head. But that's another way to do the high-end power if you're looking, if you're looking to drive a lot of power to speaker two, is just have a dedicated amp.
That's
and,
true.
And then run pre-outs.
But he also wants, so, I think he wants to buy an AVR now and not a stereo amp and not have to upgrade.
Gotcha.
Because
that can be another option I've seen on some AVRs too. Maybe it doesn't have all of the amplification channels built in, but it'll provide those last two channels as line outs or right. just straight outs that could go into another amp. And there's a thinking about three questions at once now.
Okay, so okay, let me backtrack for a second. Those Denons, the 710 and 720, are rated for 6-ohm. I found several decent ones that were rated for 4-ohm that were not particularly expensive, and of course all of those links have disappeared because we're recording right now. I would make sure that the AVR is rated for 4-ohm loads, especially if your speakers are less efficient. If your speakers are like 90 dB efficient or better, you're probably not going to get into a lot of trouble. If they are like 85 dB speakers, don't connect those 4-ohm 85 dB speakers. Don't connect those to an 8-ohm rated amp. you know, and part of the issue is, you know, most...
It won't harm anything, but it won't sound right, though, will it?
Well, I don't want to get...
Let's do an experiment.
Great. We'll do it with you. Well, let me get my new EV
with
AVR,
proper ventilation,
and then we'll do terrible things the old one. Well, you know, one of the things they point out in that Audioholics article is like, look, most mid-fi receivers are probably going to have difficulties driving a 4-ohm load. A lot of the better receivers, you know, have enough power supply, heat sink area, and current capability in the amp sections to handle 4-ohm loads. And I'm quoting directly from Audioholics right now. Quote, you're usually safe running these speakers on the flagship receiver models from Yamaha, Denon, Onkyo, Harman Kardon, NAD, and Nakamichi. So the less, you know, it's kind of really simple. We talked about the, you know, ATI 1202 amplifier. I have that stereo power amplifier.
Right.
You know, which, you know, you could use to drive a Mack truck. You know, it probably weighs 27 pounds and 18 pounds of that are
stereo?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's massive.
See, you know, but that would be something you could drive a set of speakers and not have to worry about, you know, overheating in the AVR.
Yeah.
Because it's a separate unit.
You know, they basically say, look, 4-ohm high efficiency, you know, speakers, quote, on a mid-fi receiver, yes, with proper ventilation with receiver, watch excessive volume levels, i.e. it's going to be in over its head if you turn the volume up too high. High-end receivers, you're probably okay. But they also say, look, you know, proper ventilation on the receiver, so don't stuff it in a closet. And if you're thinking like, oh, how much heat does my AVR really generate? You know, I can keep one of the closets in my house up close to 100 degrees simply by, you know, idling my AVR. And when I start turning the volume up, you know, it gets like I want to throw a pile of rocks and get a sauna going on in there.
But that tip, though, about the ohm switch or the impedance switch on the AVRs, if it has one, keeping it on high or 8 ohms all the time, regardless. The fact that it may be just related to voltage within the within the internals, and it's like, okay, that's a good tip, and I like that, and I appreciate that. And
well, they
some
also
more...
say, look, you know, use bass management, set your speakers to small. That way, you know, it shunts all the low end audio to the subwoofer and doesn't try to send it to the speakers, and that'll kind of conserve the power. You know, the you know, they call it the power hungry bass is going to be said to your sense.
This is
your
a good article. I'll be sure we have this in our show notes too.
It's good stuff. There, you know, the short answer is yes, you can find an AVR. Make sure it's rated for 4-ohm or it's one of the, you know, start spending the money for a flagship model.
Sounds like he could connect these speakers to anything, but if they specifically require 4-ohm loads, then they might just not sound right. They might sound funny if they're not being pushed properly, so to speak. I am willing to experiment.
Yeah. Well, you know, look, most cheap receivers are going to have difficulty with a 4-ohm load.
Yep. With a fact. Word. Yeah. So to speak.
It is what it is. If you want to also read another wonderful article and get some math on amplifier and power supply basics on audioholics.com.
Oh, cool.
is pretty fantastic. And they talk about amplifier DC voltages. It's really good stuff. I am a big fan of, again, I said this before, I'm a big fan of what they do, and they get science on and they explain things. And if you haven't been to Audioholics, spend some quality time there.
Agreed.
And, you know, if you are doing the, like if those 4 ohm speakers are less than 90 dB efficient, don't try to attach them to your 8 ohm AVR. If they're more efficient than that, give it a shot. But if you're buying an AVR, go out of your way to research and try to find one that's rated for 4 ohm. So, wow, that got really long. Sorry, buddy. Now I'm going to figure out what happened to those, because I had 3 or 4 affordable AVRs that were rated for 4 ohms.
Oh, shoot me. I'll include them if you got good recs.
I'll make sure
the audience knows.
Oh, you got this question. David K. on the AV Excel Facebook. You should read this one, because now I'm angry and I want to find my list of the
Breathe.
Heat has gotten to me.
Breathe. Let's see. At Ken Cobra. I like that name. Tweets. At Robert Heron, what's better, a 1080p OLED or a mid-range 4K TV, assuming LCD? And that is a good question. I would say what's better, strictly with picture quality, generally speaking, the contrast, and because of that, the way color looks as well. As contrast improves, color appears more saturated, generally speaking. And that is a compelling picture. OLED advantage, obviously. The off-axis viewing is going to be more consistent than any LCD. However, you're comparing a 1080p OLED and a mid-range 4K TV. There aren't many 4K or 1080p OLEDs left, I'm finding, unless it's something else. I was just looking at the EG9100 from LG, and I'm finding that's becoming kind of scarce now. And that was their... That was one of their entry level. You could get it for like $1,500 to $1,700 for the 55-inch 1080p OLED. Not a bad price for the time, but those seem to be going away with a quickness right now. At this point, I'm not recommending pretty much any 2015 55-inch screens just because the prices seem to be ticking up on everything. The 65-inch models from last year are still pretty good and at best prices. So I would consider maybe that. Between those two, I'm going to take the OLED if the screen sizes are relatively the same. All other things being equal, I'll take an OLED over an LCD. However, if I am dealing, depending on the LCD, maybe you're dealing with a room with a lot of light reflection and things like that, and you need a good matte finished screen that's super bright, sure. If screen size is the issue, then OLED gets really crazy expensive the bigger you get, and it only goes up to 65 inches anyway, currently. So, there is that. It's tough. I'd like to just point to one of like last year's 1080p OLEDs and say, there you go. But I'm just not sure how easy they are to find anymore. That's the main issue. And I even noticed that today. I was looking up to see, hey, are any of those left? And then I happened to notice that 2015 models for the 65 inches are at perfect pricing, in my opinion. If you want to grab something from last year at a great price. However, like I said, those 55-inch screens I'm seeing, the prices are going up above their bottom that they hit. So that means probably the stock is running out, and then wouldn't be looking so hard at that right now. I'd be focused more on the 2016 stuff that's already on sale, although for more money. So
more money.
Yeah, that's a tough question, man. If somebody's going to ask me what the best TV is, I always ask first, what's the budget? Keep you in the budget so you're not freaking out when we're done. That gotta keep the heart rate in check. Second would be screen size and to be realistic about it. And you know, I recently installed a 65-inch screen in a rather small bedroom, and honestly, it was a little big. So although I'm not complaining, I didn't think it looked bad. I was just like, wow, this is like a map on the wall here.
It may not be about what you think.
Exactly. So yeah, but, all of the things being equal, I effectively just start there. It's like the budget's going to determine everything, in terms of the technology, the screen size, the feature support that's required. Maybe you want a dumb TV and you can save a little bit of money that way. Although those could be hard to find, to be honest with you, especially in the 4K realm.
Yeah.
There's almost no dumb 4K TVs, period. Otherwise, you know, to be a good shopper, too, take advantage of sales, take advantage of tracking prices. Please don't buy anything at the peak pricing of anything. There's always a good deal to be had. And for, like I said, for 2015 products, for last year's TVs, the prices just hit their lowest point and are now ticking up, or are currently at their lowest point. So you look at the 2016 stuff, which they would much rather you buy. Those prices are just starting to become off their peak and start to tickle down throughout the rest of the year and into next year. And those are good trends to keep in mind. Yeah, if you don't need smart features on any TV, you don't have to use them. So there's one option.
And where my smart features come from? My smart features come, ladies and gentlemen, from the Apple TV and the Roku box.
There you go. I have a Chromecast that I absolutely love. I just bought one of the new ones too, and I like it. They changed the design on it and did a few other things, but it's a faster processor and it works a little bit better than the older ones did. Wi-Fi is way better on the newer ones too.
Yeah.
And it makes it so easy to...
And if you press the top, your remote sings.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. I had no idea.
On the Roku 4?
Oh, that, yeah. No, I didn't know. Press I the did top not know that either. 4. But yeah, besides that, yeah, design-wise, picture performance, it becomes a little tougher as me as a calibrator too, because I know that any TV can look better. Yeah. So the picture quality, as long as there's not some major defect or something, I know it can be improved, and it can be very comparable to a lot of other products out there, unless it's just, like I said, hosed at the factory or something, but that's pretty rare nowadays. It's so great nowadays. We don't have all of those unknown brands of TV showing up mm-hmm. with just scattergun performance where it was all over the map. Only the best survived, and they all at least know that there is one picture preset in there that's pretty close. So
it is not entirely offensive.
No. And, but I, you know what? I focus a lot on finding good values for things I would recommend too. So I'll also throw a link up, self-promotion, to a page I maintain on a weekly basis. And I just updated it today with all the...
Would that be hairandfidelity.com?
Yeah.
If you haven't been to hairandfidelity.com, I highly recommend it. It's good stuff.
I need to finish some reviews. I am sitting on a bunch of them right now. And
I've figured it out.
Back to our forum madness.
Back to our forum madness. So, you know, I was looking, right? So, you know, for like $500, Denon's AVR X2200W will handle 4-ohm loads. The AVR S720W will handle 4-ohm loads. That's for like $479. Marantz's, the NR1506, the NR1606, that's a 5.2 and a 7.2 amplifier. Something funny about Yamaha's a Vintage lineup.
Oh, those are beautiful.
They're beautiful, right? But it's funny because it's 4-ohm minimum impedance for the left and right channels, but 6-ohm for the center and surround sound channels.
Where did they spend the most money on their amps?
Well,
stereo pair.
Well, I finally realized what I was looking at the AVR 720W. They give you the power rating for 8-ohm and 6-ohm loads, but the output connectors will handle 4 to 16-ohm loads. So it's a, you know, they will handle that, you know, that entry level, you know, $479 AVR S720 or the S710 should both handle 4-ohm loads on your speakers.
Nice.
So my apologies.
Hey.
Apparently, I had the right things open. I was just reading them long. It was
one
like,
fewer amplification or correction.
Yeah. There's not 4 16-ohm outputs on that. The output
four
connectors.
4 2 16.
Yeah, 4 2 16 ohms.
4 ohms to 16.
I'm going to blame the heat.
Dude, we're roasting. Make sure your pets are watered, people, by the way.
And yourself. People forget to hydrate. But yeah, Denon and Marantz offer a bunch of affordable models that'll drive 4-ohm loads and happen to be pretty fine AVRs for the money, too.
Last AVR I installed was one of those Avantage, or whatever the hell it's called.
I like Avantage.
Avantage. That's even better. They have a sweet app, their AV controller app for Yamaha AVRs, and you can do everything to a network-connected AVR and turning power, zone control. And you can throw that on a tablet in the home if you've got your, you know, the home tablet with all your other apps for the home environment, or mm-hmm. keep it, just fire up the phone in the morning and open up the app and turn on the receiver in the living room and crank tunes before I put my feet on the floor.
Oh my goodness.
It's good stuff.
David K on the AVXL Facebook is looking for a projector for a widescreen setup. He's wanting to purchase a projector. His room is 13 feet long and he's purchased a 96-inch tube
35-1 Elite Cinegrade screen. I want a projector with auto zoom, but I need something that will work at that distance. I've looked at the Panasonic AE8000U and the JVC DLA X50R. This is a man of taste and distinguished stylings. With a 13-foot room, the throw will be around 11 to 11.5 feet. Will either of those work at that distance? Are those projectors any good? Is the Elite screen any good? Is there a different projector you would recommend? Thanks so much and keep up the good work. And first of all, props to you, David, for understanding that you are essentially creating a system.
Yes.
And you want everything to work together well. And also that, you know, by doing a widescreen setup, you bring yourself into a whole additional world of hurt over doing a standard like 16 by 10, you know, 1080p or 4K kind of situation. Are either of these going to do it without having kind of black bars that he wants to hide above and below the... I'm going to stop and Robert's going to speak.
No, that's the whole point.
Right.
All of the imagers I look at on modern projectors are 16 by 9 imaging devices. Mm-hmm. So you are trying to put a rectangle into a more narrow rectangle,
right?
Basically. And so that's the issue you're going to run into. When you fit the width of the screen in a 235-1 or the wider than 16 by 9 shape, you then are sacrificing some of the resolution on the top and the bottom of the chip that's firing that information out. Now, that said, a couple of issues. One, with widescreen content in the 1080p format, say for a Blu-ray disc, you have that 1920 pixel width of the image. The height of that image isn't the full 1080 because you have the black bars. And that's usually a very fixed value for a lot of movies. The aspect ratios aren't dramatically different among the presentations I see. Although I'm looking at, what is it, Bridge on the River Kwai?
Or right.
And this has an incredibly wide aspect ratio, far, far more than a 235-1 or 240. So
they were doing things differently back then.
Yes.
They were doing, you know, Quentin Tarantino was doing things differently a few months ago, but that's a whole nother conversation.
So in order to make those shapes fit properly, you're going to need basically a projector that has a zoom and focus preset to make it easier. Basically, you're going to need to be able to zoom in and refocus to fit that image properly in the width of that screen with the screen height you're dealing with. And then you need to, when you switch back to 16 by 9, you need to have it then zoom back to that other preset. Mm-hmm. So you need those multiple presets to be able to lock those two things down. And then you'll need a way to switch between those. And some projectors do provide automatic triggering with content detection. It's like, oh, this is letterbox content, not full frame 16 by 9. I will switch to the other preset and things like that. As far as the room size versus projectors go, there is also another way to do anamorphic, of course. You can get a playback device that will reformat that image into the 16 by 9 chip that the display device has, the projector. Hmm. And then the projector can then use an anamorphic lens to dewarp it. And then you're using the full chip, the full 1920 by 1080 pixel structure to deliver that ultra widescreen viewing experience. Whereas if you're unable to do that, mm-hmm. without using an anamorphic lens, which it's an added cost and complexity, and it's generally a lot of people will avoid it at this level with mm-hmm. these types of projectors. You're sticking with that zoom preset. You're basically setting up those two presets, one for the 235-1 movies, one for your 16 by 9 or 1.78-1 movies, and then being able to switch back and forth between those two zoom presets is going to be the way to go. Now, unless you have a masking screen of some kind on the sides, when you do 16 by 9 on your 235 screen, of course, you're going to have white bars on the sides or blocks of unused screen as you project the image, because the 16 by 9 will fill the image height before it fills the width on that widescreen format. So those are the device issues you're going to have. Before you do anything, though, take a look at both projector companies. They will provide software tools or a web app to do the calculation for that specific projector with its lens and distances, and to provide a pretty good estimation to see if that throw distance, and you're stating here that you have about 6 inches of play with your throw distance, 11 to 11.5 feet. So you just want to make sure that that's going to work for you with these particular lens setups on the two projectors in question, the Panasonic and the JVC. Both of those have zoom presets, I'm almost certain, as far as presets and focus presets mm-hmm. as well. So I think that's going to be how you're going to have to do it. And like I said, use the software tools with both projectors to make sure that you're not pushing the limits of distance. You're not too close or too far away to do the image quality and mm-hmm. the screen size you're looking to do. Also, ProjectorCentral.com.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. They have their Projector Calculator Pro.
I was actually just looking up that Panasonic PTAE8000 on there.
That's a sweet projector. It's got a waveform display built into it, so you can, like, if you really want to nerd out on what the hell, that projector is awful fun. Anyway,
no, I'm just laughing because I'm gonna have to use this inside of
if you're using Projector Central's tool, make sure you do switch the projector or the screen size aspect ratio mm-hmm. to the proper one. Make sure all your dimensions are right before you start moving the sliders around to see if it'll fit or yeah. not.
You're looking at, it's ideal for a 16:9. Well, let's go to a 239 aspect ratio just to be crazy.
Because that's the whole point of those 22:9 TVs. It was to say, when I'm looking at this widescreen content, I won't see letterbox bars. Mm-hmm. And effectively, with this setup with the zoom presets, you'll be shining, the letterbox bars will be shining off the screen, but the remaining image is what's being scaled then to that widescreen frame. And he was mentioning screen materials too. Elite screens are awesome. There are a lot of great screens out there.
I
have a recommendation for that too.
Okay. So. I just want to, you know, because I'm looking at the, you know, setting the Projector Central calculator. I had to launch it inside of
Internet Explorer.
It's the last thing.
Or whatever it's called now, Edge.
Edge, because it's the last thing that has Flash on my system. You know, but setting it, I've just crushed Flash everywhere else because it's just too many security holes.
I only use it built into Chrome.
But setting that to 11 feet, you're looking at like a 79-inch screen.
That was my concern. That's not a large throw distance for, what was the size? He's going 96?
Yeah. There's going to be a fair amount of empty space there. If you can get it out.
It's because you're dealing with a wider screen. That's mm-hmm. the other thing. You know,
by the time you get out, well, I'm looking at it in the 239 aspect ratio. If I go to 16:9, at 11.5 feet, I'm looking at an 85-inch, 86, 87, 88-inch screens.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that 239 is, you're essentially, you know, having to move the projector closer to the wall to fill the additional width on that aspect ratio.
I would also double check those results against whatever the manufacturer's mm-hmm. tool is as well, because generally when I download those tools, they usually have a database of all the projector specs built right in, baked in, and you just select the proper stuff, the screen size you're dealing with,
right.
And then it'll give you the thumbs up or thumbs down if this is in the remote possibility.
Yeah.
Now, some projectors also have alternate lens options, too, that you may want to consider. If by changing the lens, you will be able to change its throw to whatever you need if you had to, if the projector offers that functionality. If you needed more zoom to put the projector back further, or you need it up closer, and if the built-in zoom function doesn't provide mm-hmm. enough range, that's something else to consider as well. Screen-wise, I will say a buddy of mine, Chris Heinen, over at Reference Home Theater, did a roundup of screens a while back, and I want to say last year, and he found some pretty interesting things about projector screens overall. One, the high-end screens can be very good. However, there are some great values out there that offer nearly identical performance. So you don't have to spend an arm and a leg on a screen if you don't want to. Trust me, if I can go to Stewart Film Screen and have them handcraft me my favorite perforated, acoustically transparent, specifically optimized screen for my projector,
right?
You know, hell yeah. I'm going to take that trip down to Torrance, California, and have a go pick it up in person.
Well, I got to say, I do. My big dream at this point is to end up with an acoustically transparent screen.
But
so
I will
I
link
put
to
the center speakers behind it.
Chris's article on his website over at Reference Home Theater, because he did some great testing on how the screen material changes the characteristics of the picture quality. Every screen is going to produce a different grayscale and color, and it's going to be a different calibration for every type of screen you do. So that's part of that's one aspect of projection to keep in mind too. If you change any part of the display system, and it will probably change the picture quality, and that includes your light, your lamp, so to speak, as well as the screen and the room environment, be it lighting in the room or what have you. But yeah, good stuff. I love projection systems, especially in a light controlled room. There is nothing better.
Oh my goodness! You are in the midst of testing the and hey, David K, and Brian and. Thank you for your emails. All right. Thank you for posting it on Facebook.
Aiden
thank you,
DeJong.
Yeah, Aiden. Thank you. Thank you for posting on Twitter. Brian, thank you for emailing us. We said it before, we'll say it again. At Robert
FM Holti. I got to. Yes. You are just awesome. Informative.
Yes. And at Ken Cobra. Ken everyone. Cobra. Everyone who sends us an email or tweets or posts on Facebook.
We're back awesome. In the love mode.
Ask at techthing.com, at Robert Heron, at Patrick Norton, yes. at AVXL, facebook.com/AVXL, or ask at AVXL. You guide us and tell us where to go. Somewhere out there is a college student with no money that is going to miss the home theater system at home and is going to ask us how to turn their dorm room into a perfect cinematic environment. And I'm waiting for your question.
720p projector.
They're getting really affordable. KS9800 update. Robert is testing this gorgeous 65-inch curved screen, $4,500 full array local dimming, 1300 nit.
Man,
will this be the best LCD TV or the best, I should say, the best UHD TV of 2016? We wait with bated breath.
We do. We do. I am. My eyes are drawn to it. I am watching an old piece of video that's been.
You're watching Bridge Over the River Kwai, man.
Converted to 4K through Netflix streaming. And it is. Even this is compelling looking to me.
This was a pretty well shot movie.
Well, this is a classic too that I should just have in my repertoire to say I've seen.
Wow, that's a lot.
I'm getting
list.
Caught up in a lot of movies lately. The trick if is I could stop watching American Dad for 5 minutes, Netflix, why do you have that on there?
Just to ruin your life.
There's a character on that show, Roger the Alien, who might be my favorite TV personality of all time. anyway, that's my. That's my recommended watching for the week, old episodes of American Dad.
Oh, my goodness.
If I had to pick one episode, no.
Don't do it. Don't do it. We got one more thing before we go, Olympic updates.
Yeah.
4K, HDR, and Atmos, all are supposed to be supported on the 4K streams or the 4K broadcast. Yes, you are going to have to wait an extra day, except, by the way, for the opening and closing ceremonies, which will be in a 2.5-hour delay. 4K HDR Atmos for swimming, track and field, basketball, and judo. Everything's being shot in 8K. I think we talked about that last week.
Everything is shot in 8K, but all the main events, there will be at least one 8K camera.
All
everywhere.
The 4K stuff is going to be
shot
in 8K.
All the 4K stuff's being sampled from the 8K cameras, and I'm like...
Downsampled.
Exactly. Ain't going up. they mentioned too, the Variety article talked about other options where you'd be able to watch this content. We talked about DirecTV's offerings, but Comcast, the parent company of NBC Universal,
dun, dun, dun.
As I quote from the Variety article, they are bringing basically for Samsung and LG TVs, and I'm assuming it's probably some of the newer ones,
yeah.
You will be able to do the Comcast app and stream that content to those TVs. I'm not seeing any love for Sony here, but at least if you're a Comcast subscriber, you do have that option on the Samsung and LG TVs. Using the Xfinity Ultra High Definition Sampler app. How funny. Yeah. That app's been sitting there forever, and I'd never even look at it, and maybe I'll actually fire it up this time just to get some Olympic action going. And if you're a Dish customer and you have that Hopper 3 DVR or the 4K Joey, you will have... 4K Olympic footage on linear channel 146.
Nothing wrong with that. Something, you realize...
Along with other content, too.
There's a lot of... You realize there are a metric ton of events at the Olympics.
I'm a wee bit disappointed in this day and age. I really thought since the last Olympics had so much online streaming, I really thought they would just hit it with all live 4K, up to 4K, mega stream it. Push it, man.
You know what they've got to do? They're basically, I guess they don't want to re-render it live, maybe, or they're editing it
something.
Down.
Yeah. Well, I'd be curious to know why.
I think I have some ideas here. Look, 83 hours of programming in UHD on a delayed basis. You know, one day for the majority of the events, 2.5 hours for the opening and closing ceremonies. If you go to NBC Olympics...
all 83 hours are in 4K?
Hold on. There's 83 hours of 4K.
Okay.
Brace for impact. If you go to nbcolympics.com/news/how-to-watch-Rio 2016 Olympic Games, they are expecting to have 6,755 hours of programming from the games of the 31st Olympiad from Rio de Janeiro. That's roughly because multiple events are going on simultaneously. They're looking at capturing something like 356 hours of coverage per day across the 19 days. Again, that's 6,755 hours, which, quote, If it ran on one channel, it would take 281 days to finish airing.
Yeah, but all of this content will require a subscription service in order to get into it.
Well, it's kind of I don't think they're going to make all 6,755 hours.
Oh no,
available.
They'll give you the opening ceremonies. Well, the closing ceremonies.
But here's what's happening: NBC Universal will present 2,084 hours of Olympic programming across 11 networks. So think about that: 83 hours in 4K, 2,084 hours of Olympic programming across 11
all
networks,
of it, yeah.
Which includes NBC, Telemundo. I don't think all of it's going to be on all the channels.
No,
but NBC, Telemundo, Bravo, CNBC, Golf Channel, MSNBC, NBC Sports Network, NBC Universo, USA Networks, and then various specialty channels for basketball and soccer.
Yep.
The NBC Sports app, which is powered by Playmaker Media at NBCOlympics.com, will live stream 4,500 hours, including all Olympic competition, they say, for the third consecutive Olympics.
I'm going to go check and see what kind of login credentials you'll need, if any.
Yeah, authenticated pay TV subscribers via TV everywhere to desktops, which is really irritating. And they're supposed to do VR programming, which is, of course, going to be on Samsung devices.
Oh, okay. So, well, I will try that.
Yeah. 260 hours of universal coverage or coverage on NBC. So the 4K is going to be like one third of the 260 hours.
All right.
So
it's coming.
MSNBC gets like 330 hours across like 20 sports. Which
maybe
is going to include
4 years from now. It'll all be 4K streamed.
Well, they need the bandwidth, right? But I mean, think about it, right? If you look, you're talking about an astronomical amount of video. So NBC gets the big stuff: swimming, gymnastics, track and field, diving, beach volleyball, the men and women's basketball finals.
It would be nice if they archive these sites permanently too.
Yeah, that would be pretty amazing.
Oh, that's the other thing too. The content's like there for a week or two, and then it just sort of goes into special.
That relay
package
with Michael Phelps, I could watch it.
So
I don't
much.
Watch
I
swimming,
like,
but I could watch that relay
like
where he.
Freaking YouTube, where I can just go back and watch anything, anytime in full quality. And
yeah,
I'll put up with a commercial here and there.
You know, the NBC Sports Network is going to get track and field, archery, boxing, cycling, fencing, field hockey, judo, open water swimming, rugby, shooting, soccer, synchronized swimming, table tennis, weightlifting, and wrestling. I'm going to miss seeing wrestling on the main channels. The Golf Channel is going to get 115 hours of tournament programming of golf, which is back in the Olympic Games. Bravo is going to get Olympic tennis. CNBC is doing some late night stuff with a whole mixture of things. It's a pretty crazy mix.
The summer games have arrived.
The USA Network gets the opening and closing ceremonies.
Of course.
Telemundo and NBC Universo get a 273 hours of coverage, including women's soccer.
That should be awesome.
Yeah, it's.
I can't wait.
It's pretty crazy when you start breaking it down. They're going to have two Olympic specialty channels on NBC Universal for basketball and soccer, and they're going to do 779 hours of content just for those two sports. So, you know, it's.
The moneymakers.
The moneymakers. And they also, they kind of know where the most passionate, they're programming for the most passionate viewers. I thought it was interesting. HD Guru had an article. Snell Advanced Media did a survey. One third of Americans would like to watch the Olympics on Netflix as if it were available. Half of Americans said they will watch at home via their live cable or satellite TV this year. You know, so it's interesting. It is.
I'd be pretty sweet if Netflix or Amazon had the Olympics.
It would be amazing. But also, I mean, you know, that gets back to that crazy number we talked about at the beginning. There is
such a world
of thousands
event.
Of hours.
I mean, I understand premium sports programming. But this is such an international thing.
6,755 hours of shooting, you know, spread across 19 days. There is so much going on. They literally must have hundreds of cameras down there shooting.
Fire hose the data. That's not even a fire hose, a hydrant.
Yeah, props to whoever's doing all the back end work.
May
on
they
this.
Be documenting some of this too, because hopefully they show the how to or how it was made or something. I'd be curious to see. They always end up talking about their camera systems. Mm-hmm. Like the last time around, that was where those 500 frame plus capable cameras, really every camera could suddenly do that. So here they are just shooting the regular thing, and they could just instantly go into slow mode on any of the live shots they had, and that was fantastic.
Yeah.
And that carried over now into every motorsports event that I watch has those cameras that are even better performing now.
I suddenly wish I was at the National Association of Broadcasters to go look in the Sony and Panasonic and Grass Valley booth to see those crazy bleeding edge 4K cameras.
God, you want to see some cool slow-mos like F1 racing or MotoGP with the motors, any of those motorsports where they can slow it down so much, and you're reading like the tire information as the tire rotates at 150 miles an hour.
What a maximum PSI on that is.
I'm just like, that's insane. It's cool though.
Amazing.
And I'm curious to see what they'll have for this year technology wise in terms of what are these 8K cameras? Probably Sony NHK or something like that. We'll see.
Oh my goodness.
I'm as curious about that as I am the Olympic events themselves. So
they're always trying to find some way to make it more approachable to non-experts and to kind of make it easier to understand.
I wish
what's
the
going
athletes
on.
The best.
Yes.
It may be an awesome event.
Yes. And I hope it is safe and awesome and chill, and we all get to see amazing, uplifting moments for all of us. And
heck yeah.
Oh my goodness. 17 Russian athletes.
Good.
Are making it.
Awesome.
Yeah. Rough year for Russian Olympic team.
My roommate's like the Tour de France fanatic, and I just perpetually make fun of him about that. It's like, oh, hey, have they kicked in the motors yet? Those hidden motors? Who's doping this year? It's like, which one's doing the most dope?
There went the love, and we're back to broiling under the hot roof. With that, ladies
with
and gentlemen, oh my goodness.
Boiling with love.
AVXL.com is the place to go to find all of our episodes, to learn more about the show, to find links on the RSS feeds or iTunes and all that good stuff if you want to keep up with us, and we hope you do. If you want to, if you got something useful in this show, if you want to keep us going, do us a favor, go over to patreon.com/AVXL. And thank you so much for listening. Tweet at us at AVXL. Email us, ask@AVXL. We love your questions, and we'd love to hear if you're gonna. Are you gonna watch the Olympics? Do you care? Are you beyond that now?
I have to. I mean, they're using some of the latest camera technologies in the highest resolutions to record live events, and that's some of the most challenging things of all. Studio, late night, primetime TV, where they're sitting in a nice controlled studio with lighting, and you got two or three expert professionals walking around, fine-tuning every little section of the stage.
I still think
compared to an outdoor event with natural this and that and the unexpected. And
oh my goodness, we have friends who work professionally switching and or shooting cameras for college and professional sports events. And man, you want to talk about a high pressure environment? I can't imagine like what a nightmare it is to be covering a golf event.
Well,
because, you know, it's
like our buddy Josh, man.
Yeah.
He seems to be getting all the good gigs of late. And for Bay Area sports events, he's done all of them, including the World Series and a few others. And
it's, you know, this is not a forgiving environment. And think about it. If you can't follow that ball off the bat, if you can't catch that spike in the volleyball event, if you are not, you know, man,
he's a good physical specimen. However, his attitude is one of the best, too, I've seen in the industry.
He's
just
people.
One of those personable, honest, cool folks, and that's why he's one of the most sought-after cameramen in the Bay Area.
Ladies and gentlemen,
Josh V, shout out to you.
In the immortal words of one of the finest movies of our age, be excellent to each other. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, and I'm Robert Herron.
We'll see you next week on AVXL.